Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast. Today, I'm just so happy to have John Galloway back. John, how are you?
I'm doing great. Happy to be back.
John is a buddy, and he is brilliant, and he's a technical evangelist for Microsoft, and he knows about all things cool. So we're going to talk about build, and then if time allows, we can talk about all sorts of other stuff like open source and how Microsoft entirely going clearly to open source and whatever else comes to mind.
Sounds great.
So you were at Build. I saw you. You were on Channel 9. You were a talking head.
I was. Yep. Yeah. So that was my busiest day there. I was helping with a keynote presentation that morning. And as soon as my demo ended, I was working on reviewing and prepping for a talk I was giving. But between those two things, I ran over to Channel 9. They popped a mic on me. We did the talk. And then I took the mic off and ran up to my presentation and spoke for an hour or so.
And what did you present on?
This year was interesting. We started this new thing called Code Labs, where we would fill up a room with laptops that had all the software pre-installed. They had courseware and they had an instructor up at the front of the room who would kind of guide you through doing the work. And so the idea was, you know, we got a bunch of developers here. Some of them would prefer to write code than watch PowerPoint presentations. And so let's do that, you know. And I've gone to labs before that were boring or a waste of time or I lost interest in or, you know, other synonyms for that problem because they weren't organized. They'd either give me a computer and nobody to make it interesting, or they would give me, I would bring my own laptop and I'd spend half the time with something wrong with my software. So anyhow, this year we had a group of people. I did the web dev track. Pete did the IoT track. You know, we had a total of six different tracks, I believe, in total. We had, you know, data and we had DevOps and mobile dev, all kinds of stuff. So I did 1 hour. I did the there were four tracks in the web or four sessions in the web dev track, and it repeated every day. So we had an intro, we had kind of a 201, 301 level on, so the intro to to ASP.NET Core, and then there was a kind of deeper dive into ASP.NET Core, which was the one I did. And then we had a deployment and Azure session, and then we had a final session on building single page apps with Angular 2 and ASP.NET Core.
I really want to go. I didn't go to Build this year, and that just sounds incredible.
You know, it would have been great to have you there, but part of the cool thing with this, of course, we published all the content on GitHub, so it's all there, and the lab docs are very thorough. They have all the source code, so you can, you know, if something's not working, you can open up the completed sample at a bunch of different checkpoints along the way. And then they're also like, there's a lot of text. Like I spent a lot of the past month and a half working on building up these lab docs. So that's the idea. And then I also am supposed to record them, like either Camtasia or in a studio, going back and forth on which. But so that's, that would be like being there at the class, at least.
Great. So in our show notes, we'll put a link to where you get the material on GitHub.
Yep.
Is GitHub I know it's become the ubiquitous way of distributing these kinds of things, but is it really, do you find it to be a very efficient and helpful way to distribute?
I think it's the best now. It's kind of, I'm always searching for the best way to distribute, especially like training information, because this is a combination of lab documents, source code. We have some PowerPoint slides in there if people want to review what we showed or use them themselves. But some things that worked out really well for us. Number one was we edited all the documents in Markdown. That allowed me I had some of the instructors or proctors, you know, making edits and sending up pull requests or committing them. We had other developers we work with to help build these out. So it was really, Markdown's a great format for collaborative editing because you can diff things and very quickly see what's changed. And it also kind of forces you to keep things simple. I've seen lab documents written up in Word and people start going crazy with the, I don't know, weird formatting or SmartArt or what have you. And then so Markdown kind of forces this real simplicity. And then of course, you know, it's good for source code.
Now, are you doing the embedded C# in the Markdown so that people can interact with it right in the documentation?
We're not doing that. So that was something that they showed. If we're talking about the same thing, I mean, we have code snippets in the document, and we also have code snippets that are installed in Visual Studio for the Visual Studio portion. So you can, you know, type. So we'll say, here, we're going to type this code in, but I'm not going to make you type all that. Just type these, you know, type this phrase and then hit tab and it'll expand it out.
But the inspector that I'm thinking of is really a Xamarin thing, not a general documentation.
It is. Yep. And there have been different, you know, kinds of interactive developer, you know, web-based developer tools or interactive developer tools. They've been growing over time. You know, like when I was first getting going with web dev, everything was trial and error. And I would, you know, go, for instance, CSS, I would go and type some properties and refresh the page. Oh, that didn't work. And then do it again and again. And then, you know, they started adding in like web developer tools that let you do that. And then, of course, we've seen browser-based compilers for things, you know, a lot of different programming languages, JavaScript, of course, but also .NET languages and all over. So what Xamarin showed that was really cool was an Android emulator and a document. And the document was written in Markdown format, and it had code snippets in it. And editing the code snippets and hitting Shift Enter would cause it to execute the code.
Yes.
And that was brilliant. So, I mean, when I saw that, my jaw kind of dropped. That was actually one of the demos I helped with backstage. Normally, when I'm working on demos, there's, you know, a good month or so that goes into writing code and making fallbacks and all this stuff. But what was brilliant about Miguel's demos was that he dropped two controls onto a form. Mm-hmm. He wrote two lines of code, and then that was enough to show like, wow, this iOS emulator has multi-touch, has, you know, has all, it's showing an iOS emulator running on Windows, which is pretty magical. And then he switched over to the inspector and showed the document hooked up to an Android emulator. And he didn't have to write any code there, really. He just modified the code snippets that were in the document. And that was enough to like blow my mind again, right? So
right. And then the inspector just keeps doing that to you, because not only can you do this kind of interactive programming, but anything that you bring up, member of or property or field or whatever, assuming the inspector knows about its type and it knows about a great many types, then it can show you right in line. So if you bring up an image, it shows you the image. Bring up a map, you've got an interactive map. You can use it for learning how to do things in C#. You can use it for document. I mean, it's pretty extraordinary.
Oh yeah, and I just love that kind of like interactive. You know, it's like a Socratic conversation with. So instead of just throwing things at a wall or, you know, reading documents that are, then you have to carefully reread. Oh, I forgot I have to use this in this circumstance. This is great to just, here's some working code. And now how does this change if I add in a rotation command or if I change the animation time?
Right.
Thing? Yeah.
So clearly there were a lot of things in new in Xamarin, and I can point folks at my write-up of what's new in Xamarin, but there were a whole lot of other new things and announcements and instruction at Build, and maybe you could take us through at least the parts that you were involved in and that you feel comfortable with.
Well, sure. There was a lot going on. As far as keynotes, there were, trying to summarize hours of keynotes is difficult, but so I'll get it wrong, but I'll do my best. So there was some stuff for Windows 10. They announced this anniversary update, which had a bunch of different features. They showed, I like the inking portions of that demo. They showed off, you know, that they're adding a lot more support for inking. I love touch on Windows 10. I've got it on my laptop. I've got 3 touchscreen desktops. So I actually use it quite a bit. So that was exciting for me. They did show off a lot of just kind of...
I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you. What's new in touch in the anniversary edition that isn't in Windows 10?
Well, so they showed some things like a simple case was bringing up a ruler. So, and then using that ruler, anything you draw is aligned to that ruler, right? Mm-hmm. So kind of bringing the advantage of like sometimes, otherwise you say you're doing something geometric, you've got to draw it on your desktop and then scan it in and convert it or whatever. He did a simple case of here's a PowerPoint. I'd like to align 3 things at a 15-degree angle, takes a ruler, rotates it to 15 degrees, holds it down, and then you know, moves things and they snap onto it. So that's kind of neat. Yeah. And, you know, just some simple things like bringing up notes, handwriting some notes in. And he said, remind me to, you know, whatever, call my mom in an hour. And then it automatically, Cortana sees that and goes, oh, okay, I'll add a reminder. So, and they did a lot of different things with that as well, like with just general intelligence for Cortana. So it's not just a, you know, text-to-speech or, you know, like I give it a specific command. It's more kind of watching and helping out, you know, along.
Yes.
So that's kind
yes.
of.
Yes. I just a short digression. I've been using Google's mail and virtually every time I hit reply, there are three choices at the bottom that I could use for the reply. Mm-hmm. And 95% of the time, they're exactly what I want.
It's I really like where we're going with computers just getting to be a lot more useful, right? I mean, just...
But it's what you were saying, that it's not just giving direction. It's that it's like they're watching while you're working and then they're making suggestions. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty astounding.
It is. And I love where, you know, computers working behind the background or having some awareness of what I do rather than just being a little bit smarter with the specific commands I give it. Mm-hmm. Is neat. You know, just like, and I know this is on coming out on, you know, a lot of different mobile platform kind of things, but I pop open my Cortana during the trip and it's like, hey, I see you've got a flight. You want me to get you an Uber? Yes, please. You know, I don't have to open up the Uber app or anything. It just does it. You know, so that was a lot of kind of this anniversary update. If you're interested in that, they just released a preview insiders build yesterday. That had some of those things. And of course, one of the big things that I didn't even mention was Bash on Windows. That's in this preview. And that's kind of a mind-blowing. I think it's mind-blowing for both. Technically, it's interesting, but also it's Microsoft that's doing it. So basically, they brought over a Linux subsystem from Ubuntu, and they brought that into Windows 10.
Yes, and it's cool that they did that. It's astounding that Microsoft did that. But why is it useful?
It's useful for a lot of cases where, and so over the years, there have been a good amount of developers, especially web developers, who have either, you know, been carrying a Mac around or have moved over to Mac as a developer. And you know, one reason for that is that there are a good amount of interesting developer tools over the years that only work or are written assuming you're running on some kind of Linux-based machine. Mm-hmm. So some examples of that, I mean, of course, Ruby is one where Ruby and Rails kind of work on Windows, but they're not. It's you're not going to be happy. Node actually started that way, but then a lot of work was put in by a lot of different people to make Node actually work pretty darn well on Windows. But there are still some things. There are these things called native modules for Node. Somehow we've decided to take a JavaScript-based development platform, mostly for web, and we've decided to throw in some platform-specific C++ and build and compile tools into JavaScript. So,
yep.
So there are cases where, you know, Node modules won't install well on Windows, or you've got to jump through a bunch of hoops. So those are cases where you say, like, okay, I need a Linux-based machine. So, you know, Mac is a common one. Of course, Ubuntu or will work well. So, for instance, in the web dev labs, short digression here, in the web dev labs, we wanted to do cross-platform development. I wasn't going to put in a separate laptop at every desk. What I did was I had Windows, and then I had an Ubuntu VM, right? And that's enough to show things. But let's say you actually just wanted to be able to do that, you know, run those things on Windows. It turns out that Windows has had these subsystems for a long time. They have this abstraction kind of layer that allows subsystems that can really pretty natively support things and then in user mode and then kind of at this deeper level translate those calls when they're called into kernel mode. So it's kind of a lot more native and less hacky than you may have seen for other kind of let's sort of make Linux work on Windows solutions. This really it is running the user mode commands. So to answer your question, a lot of the different, you know, I mean, any kind of you can apt-get, you can install. These are and the terms I'm not good with, but it's these native ELF binaries, you know, ported for Windows. So you can apt-get, you can run bash commands. A lot of you could do, you know, Ruby based development. You could do.
I can go back to using awk.
You can. Go you ahead. Can awk and sed and grep and all that stuff to your heart's content. So, but really, this kind of I think this makes more sense when you see Microsoft moving over from being this platform that they wanted people only to develop for, and moving to Windows being a platform that you could develop from. So meaning I can take a Windows machine and I can do anything. Right. I can build apps for Android and iOS and Windows using Xamarin. I can run, all the bash commands I can do. And then, of course, all the best stuff of Windows as well. So it's kind of trying to make Windows a great developer platform. And, you know, one thing I didn't even mention was there's this MaxPath thing, which can be, as a developer, you can run into from time to time. That's your full file path cannot be longer than 260 characters. So there are cases where you run into that and it'll drive you crazy. And they are actually working on that. There was a session where they talked about some changes they're making and you know, they've made changes in .NET and all this stuff. Because the frustrating thing about this is actually the file system does support it. There's just little bits along the way, Explorer and different things have not. But Bash doesn't have that limitation and it can natively mount the file system. And so, you know, just simple things like that. So you can, for instance, if you wanted to, you're having problems with the file, it's not installing or whatever under say npm on Windows, on the Windows subsystem, pop open a bash script, npm install it from there or something.
So let's turn to what I think of as your area of expertise, which is, well, I don't know whether to call it ASP.NET or something larger than that. First, help me with the nomenclature and what the global name is for things web.
I don't know. I have such a hard time. People say, what's your specialty or what do you do? And I'm like, well, this and this and this. So I generally, focus on web development on the Microsoft platform. But then, sometimes people say like, oh, so you're like an expert on Edge or so you're a, this evangelist. And I think, well, the ASP.NET is kind of where I started. I was an ASP.NET MVP. And so I really feel like that's kind of my main focus. And then, of course, Azure, you'll need to deploy your application. So there's different places you deploy it. Of course, that's expanded with ASP.NET Core. So how you deploy those applications using IIS on Windows, but then also there's Kestrel and you can deploy it cross platform. And then there's Azure as well. So there's Azure App Service is kind of in the whole Azure universe. That's kind of my main focus. And that's kind of where you can just, Azure App Service is the kind of more platform as a service kind of idea where I can just say like, okay, deploy this to there. And then it can manage scaling and all that kind of stuff.
So let's talk a little bit about ASP.NET and what's new there. And it seems from the outside looking in that the two major forks are ASP.NET in some form or another running on other platforms such as the Mac, and then new aspects to thinking about ASP.NET MVC. Is that a fair starting point?
Those are important things to talk about. So as far as running cross-platform, really an important distinction there is that it is, there's not kind of a, here's ASP.NET for Windows and here's the cross-platform version. Like really going forward, it's just ASP.NET Core. That's the new name for it. It had previously been called ASP.NET 5 and they changed the name to ASP.NET Core for a few reasons. One being that really it's a new product. It's different enough that it would confuse people to call it ASP.NET 5. So the idea with ASP.NET Core is it's built and tested across multiple platforms. And gosh, it's hard to know where to start. I mean,
let me start you with what you said, which is that it's different enough. Can you just highlight a few things that are significantly different from ASP.NET to ASP.NET Core?
Sure. One thing that's not significantly different, and we can talk about it in the MVC part, but they really tried to focus on, as an app developer, file new project, add in a model, scaffold something, deploy it, like that all should feel pretty much like, oh, it's just the next version. So I always tell people when I'm teaching you or when I'm explaining it, do you want me to scare you or do you want me to make it not scary? Do you want me to give you the non-scary thing so your boss will say, oh yeah, sure, we'll upgrade to that? So the non-scary side is, as an app developer, there are new features, but it hasn't changed. Like your existing workflows should be the same. But the scary side is, or the things have changed significantly side, to say it better, is the whole stack's different. So all the way down to the runtime and the compiler, in order to make it cross-platform and also fix a lot of things that have kind of bugged us over the years, have been changed. So there's a new runtime, compiler, host. So instead of assuming you're running this with IIS, there's this Kestrel server that's a kind of lightweight server, very similar to Node.exe, kind of in philosophy. So that's different. And then, you know, basically the ASP.NET stack has changed quite a bit. The way that it used to work was it was more of a, your application would kind of run inside of ASP.NET. And so you had a few little switches. You could raise your hand and say, hey, please, I would like to change when somebody does this, can I do this instead? But you had just a few little switches and controls. So it really could be kind of constraining. You would write huge things in web config to turn on and off handlers and stuff. So you really were kind of inside of the ASP.NET system. And they've changed that. So now you run on top of middleware, and everything is turned on and off through middleware. So that's actually the session that I did as part of the web dev track was all talking about middleware. And the difference is that middleware can completely interact with the stack, with the HTTP request and response, and has a lot of power without requiring a lot of code and, you know, none of this, you know, going in and editing configuration all the time, anytime you want to change behavior. So that's really, I think, the biggest thing is just this whole middleware rebuild as far as ASP.NET goes.
So let me ask you this. If I pulled out last year's copy of your book on ASP.NET and MVC, and I sat down with the newest, latest, greatest tools and ASP Core and so on, what would my experience be like? Oh, I have to tinker here and there, or just toss the book out the window?
Well, so the parts that are application building specific, so especially the parts that are like, hey, here's how to build an app with MVC.
Mm-hmm.
That stuff is, you know, identical in a lot of cases or pretty similar in a lot of cases. But then when you get into stuff like, here's how you kind of more in depth modify how ASP.NET works, those are places where you'll say, wait a minute, this is a whole new thing. So, you know, for instance, as you dig into things like changing the workflow, changing things in security, changing things in like filters, there's also some changes with Web API and MVC, how those two interact. It used to be that Web API and MVC had different controller base classes, and now they've been merged together. So an MVC controller, well, there's just a controller, and it can respond to both MVC and API requests.
Got it.
Yeah.
Now, you said in your presentation that you used Angular 2 as the front end. Was that an arbitrary decision, or has Microsoft embraced Angular 2 to some degree?
Well, to some degree, I think is a good way to say it. You know, the whole kind of idea is that Microsoft or ASP.NET in general they've really tried to focus on what are the places where we should be prescriptive and where we can add a lot of value, and let's do that, you know, like, so say for instance, they've added some stuff in localization. That's really something where you need the stack to be, to have some pretty good support and have that pretty well built out. But then there's other places where you say, you know, there's a new JavaScript framework every week. There's no real clear winner on front end web dev stacks. That's not something we need to, you know, try and play kingmaker or try and guess, you know, and really jump, like steer you into one direction. So they definitely have, like, for instance, at the MVP summit in November, we had Brad Green from the Angular team from Google come and spend an hour talking about Angular to the MVPs.
That was very cool.
Yeah. And he was again, and team, they did a session at Build this year. So there definitely is some support for that. There's like, hey, Angular is very popular and, you know, developers want to know about it. And we're all about that. Like, let's help developers do great stuff. So really a lot of what the web dev tracks I was working on and a lot of other things that kind of in general I heard with build planning is don't be so heavy-handed from a product focus. Here's what we're selling this year kind of thing, but really kind of gear things towards what's a web, like for my track, what does a web dev want to know? And I think in general, if you ask for a show of hands in a class, most people are kind of thinking more towards Angular. There's other stuff out there, of course. There's React. I really like React. There's Ember. There's a lot of different front-end stacks people are working with. But for this one, it was kind of like Angular is as good a place as any. And we actually decided to work with Angular 2, which is the upcoming version of Angular. It's not the, you know, there are parallels between what Microsoft's done with ASP.NET moving to ASP.NET Core and Angular 1.x moving to Angular 2.
Yes, I turned to John Papa as my resident Angular expert. And for a long time, I said to him, Angular 1 or Angular 2? And he said, absolutely 1. 2 is not code. And then one day, magically, he said, no, definitely Angular 2. It's ready. Go for it.
You know, so yeah.
I was just going to say, so clearly they've turned a corner there.
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, so I did some investigation with Angular. I feel like it's something that, you know, I need to be at least relatively familiar with a lot of front-end stacks in my job. But also, I really just love building with a lot of these front-end stacks. So I learned about Angular 1, and there were some things I liked, but there were some frustrations. I felt like I was working pretty hard for the benefit I got. So yes, it handled a lot of things for me, but then I ended up with all these models, views, controllers, and services and you know, dependency injection, and just tons of different concepts and files, and you know, so many different. The learning curve just never seemed to stop with Angular 1 as well, because as soon as I started doing something, then I'd read a blog post like, yeah, you shouldn't do it that way. You should move all that code out of your controller, put it in a service. And then people are like, you shouldn't jam that in a service. What you should be doing is, you know, and so I was like, okay, this can be a productive system. It is prescriptive. It works, but I don't like doing it, you know? And then I looked at React, and I really liked some, I had to hold my nose at first with React because I don't like how it kind of throws HTML and CSS semantics and kind of sacred cows out the window and just says, don't worry about it. We'll write your HTML for you. And if you view source, it's like throw up in your mouth HTML. But the workflow is,
there's a lovely expression. I like that.
But the workflow is really nice. And the overall kind of component-based, the way you're building components is like, oh, this is beautiful. It's a breath of fresh air because there's not so many crazy concepts here with all the injected services. And it's just not, I've already got that on my back-end server code. I don't need to deal with that again in the front end. So So React had me really excited. And honestly, as we're ramping up to this, I'm like, okay, I know we got to do Angular, but I'd really rather be doing React. Like, but I'll do it, you know, that's fine. But then I have to say, as we wrote this out and we're using Angular 2, we're like, okay, it's far enough along. And I really like what they've done with it. It's a lot of things have simplified down. A lot of things are just kind of cleaner, and I'm spending more time writing my application code and less time worrying about if I'm putting my code in the right place. The use of components is nice. The way that it works so well with TypeScript is actually pretty nice.
Am I right that the learning curve for creating a web application, a good, well-built Microsoft Stack web application, that learning curve has become quite deep and quite long?
Well, it depends what you want to build. So, I mean, to turn that around, to build any web application, to build a good web application, it depends how you define, you know, good, well-built web application. I mean, I can do file new project with MVC, slap on a new Bootstrap theme and deploy it in under an hour. Like, that's nothing, you know? So, but the problem is what people are using the web for continues to grow. I mean, we're recording this on Zencastr, which is a web app, right? And that wasn't in your list of what a website needs to be, you know, just a few years ago. So, I mean, the whole what you're doing is the whole question, right? And then also the developer choices you make. You know, there's different things where, well, I could do this on the back end. It would be a little bit more interactive if I could move it over to the front end. So, you know, then now I'm dealing with, you know, what's my front end web stack? And because I got a front end web stack, how do I test that code as well? And how do I handle the build process? And how do I, you know, so now we've got development both for, you know, client side stuff and server side stuff. And then, you know, making sure that my client side stuff looks good when it's built out using, you know, when it's using generated code as well, or you know, my DOM's constantly changing. So it kind of depends. You know, I mean,
like mostly.
Yeah.
How long is a piece of string?
Yeah. Well, and you know, to be honest, things have gotten a lot easier to build a website if you were trying to build these complex or front end heavy systems. Like, that was really hard years ago, and it's gotten significantly easier. So, but I think the thing is that what's mainstream and what's expected in a web app has changed over the years. And
yes, I mean, I've been experiencing this for 25 years, which is what I'm building now will be much easier next week, but that's not what they're going to ask for next week.
That's it. That's exactly it. Right. So, and you know, I mean, that was fun. We talked about, you mentioned that Channel 9 thing. We talked about some of those things on there, and sitting to my right during that talk was Mads Christensen is just amazing at, like, he loves all this front end web dev stuff, and watching how he's integrating that into Visual Studio, into all these little extensions he's building, and constantly thinking about, like, he's always building web stuff, and then he's thinking about how, what would I like, you know? So I like that thinking as far as.
Yes. But let me point out to you that the number one course on Pluralsight, and has been for a while now, since like November, is Sean Wildermuth's course, Building a Web App with ASP.NET Core, RC1, MVC 6, Entity Framework 7, and Angular 2. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a hell of a name for a course, and it's marked beginner, which I love. And so, again, I keep coming back to, well, if you come to me and you say you want to build a modern web application with high performance, that even if it's a straightforward business application, there's a lot you need to know now.
Yeah, but you know, I'd counter that with, you could write the same title 10 years ago and mention the ADO framework you're using, right? Or yes. Mention whatever. I mean, and mention a lot of different like parts of the stack. I think there he's just being descriptive and saying, here are the different versions of everything I'm using. I mean, you always needed to get your data out of the database somehow. You probably, you know, maybe if it was, you know, depending how many years ago, but you would say whatever version of jQuery you're using, right? So, I mean, it is a long name for what's in the course. I will say that one thing that has gotten more fiddly over the years is how you configure things. So, like, how you're hooking up Angular 2 into an ASP.NET application, that'll take you a little bit of time, unless you can, you know, use a starter project. That's actually kind of a lot of what we did in our course, is we kind of set things up and then said, okay, go from there. And there's others, Shane Boyer, I'm sure, I'm guessing that Sean may have used one. And a lot of people have published these kind of starter projects that already have those kind of the Angular 2 kind of plumbing hooked up. There are some things where you have to hook up System X, and you've got to hook up your TypeScript compiler and some different things along there. But once you've got that in place, like, I don't feel like that it's, yeah, I guess we're back to what people expect in a basic website has gotten bigger, right?
Yes. And you know, aside from my jealousy of Sean for being, you know, doing so well with his Pluralsight course, it's an incredibly good course. But from somebody who's coming in cold, saying, okay, what do I need to learn to do the cool things that other people are doing, right? There are all these cool kids who are building these cool sites. What do I need to learn? That's not a trivial undertaking. Not that it ever was a trivial undertaking, but that's still not a trivial undertaking, even though some things have gotten easier.
Yeah, it is true. I guess one other nice thing, though, is that things continue to get more transferable. So, for instance, a lot of the, you know, skills and code and things like can move between different platforms a little more easier. Like, so let's say you learn all these things, well, you can use a lot of these to package up mobile apps as well. So part of what we did at the end of our Angular 2 session was you build out a session or a site using Angular 2, and then you package it and deploy it as a Windows 10 app. And it could be that's using Manifold.js, which uses Cordova, which can package up for, you know, iOS or Android as well. So that's transferable. And then also, it used to be like, okay, I'm learning how to build all this stuff that Sean's teaching me, but it'll only run on Windows and IIS. Well, that's not the case anymore. Like, now I can take that site and I could host it on Linux, or I could dev on a MacBook, or, you know, whatever. So that really kind of is more transferable and more kind of broadly you can use your skills. And that also applies, of course, for Node dev as well. That part of the cool thing there is that's all JavaScript, and it runs on, you know, all operating systems, and it'll run, you know, JavaScript, so runs everywhere. It's probably running on your toaster. And so that's, you know, so I guess my long-winded answer there is, yeah, there's the laundry list does seem like more, but there are fewer laundry lists.
Okay, fair enough. Let me switch topics on you. Clearly, one of the hot topics at Build, although tell me if you experienced that actually being there, was the acquisition of Xamarin.
Yeah, it was. So I was involved in the keynote demo, and I was really just backstage making sure if one computer explodes, we could switch over to a backup computer. That was really kind of all I did on that, but it was fun. So that was part of that. There were some talks. I wasn't able to go to them, but you know, really just talking about Xamarin availability, and you know, everybody was hoping that when Microsoft bought Xamarin, that something good would happen from a price perspective, and so that announcement was huge.
So it went from being $1,000 per developer per year per platform to being free. I'd say, yeah, a good thing happened.
Yeah. I mean, huge. And then, you know, the availability of you know, some like integrating with Hockey App and you know, some of the stuff with like Test Cloud and all that. I mean, there's a lot of new things that were you knew theoretically you could do, but we're out of the price range of a lot of developers now. Are all kind of like, oh, you know, this is something I can get into. And the open source announcement too. It was under GPL before, and now it's under MIT. So a lot of, like, for instance, I don't know specifics, but I'd read like part of why Unity was using an older version of Mono was just it was expensive for them to get that license. Well, now with it being MIT license, that restriction is gone. They're able to, you know, build under that. So yeah.
All right, let me switch subjects slightly on you and ask you about Visual Studio. Are we seeing any significant changes there?
Well, so there were some new things that were announced and previews were made available. It's a silly thing, but it's a huge thing. Visual Studio 15 preview, which is the next version of Visual Studio.
Wait, stop right there. We have Visual Studio 2015, and then the next one is Visual Studio 15?
Deep sigh. It's, you know, it's something that we've dealt with over the years, and it's worse this year because the numbers line up. There's 15 and 2015. So for whatever reason, the Visual Studio dev team refers to the versions they're working using the version number. But then when they ship it, marketing has a marketing-based thing, and it's always very secret. What is the next version going to be called? It could be anything. It could be Visual Studio Happy Clown Edition. But no, it's always the year, but it's always a secret. So there was actually 1 year where I was presenting, and I believe it was... I forget it was Visual Studio 2015, but we had to call it Visual Studio 14. But halfway through my presentation, because I was in London, halfway through my presentation, the clock would switch over and the announcement would have been made. And now I could call it Visual Studio 2015. And because of that, I wanted to show off these features. So I did all these registry edits and hacked around and changed all my icons and everything so that it looked like it was Visual Studio 14. But then once the clock, I check my watch, my alarm goes off and I go, okay, surprise. I've been using Visual Studio 2015 this whole time. And that's the new name. Are you guys shocked? You know, and everyone's like, whatever.
So I just want to tell you, if they come out with Happy Clown Edition, you're in big trouble.
Where did you find that? Yeah. So Visual Studio 15 in quotes is the next version. And then Visual Studio 2015, they announced this update 2.4. So that's the version that's already out that was shipped in 2015. One really cool feature, watch Hanselman and Hunter did a demo with this where they had a demo machine on stage and they're like, okay, I'm going to go here and I'm going to open up Visual Studio. Oh no, you forgot to install Visual Studio on this machine. Oh no. And then he's like, someone have a USB stick, quick, we'll get the install started. And they pop in a USB stick and click, click, click. And like a minute, I don't know, a minute and a half later, they're running Visual Studio. So
wow,
it's this super fast, lightweight installer. And you can do it. Like I just did this on my, and it's also lightweight in terms of, you know, size. So, but really kind of paring down Visual Studio to be more a la carte and quick install. That's always been something that drove me crazy. It's like, why do we really need hours of, you know, what is it doing? Like, guess it's writing a bunch of COM-based registry entries, but why, you know? so that is really cool. I do recommend checking that out. That's like, if you search, you know, if you go on the Visual Studio blog or go to visualstudio.com and that install is really cool. It's limited as far as what kind of dev scenarios it supports. There's like a little menu and it's like, do you want to do C++ dev or Python dev or you know, C# desktop dev? Like there's a few different things that it natively will do, but pretty quick install. I did it over my hotel Wi-Fi really quickly. So
yeah, it sounds like you can install it faster than you can compile.
Yeah, I mean it's so that was really pretty cool. And there's of course a lot of other features, but that's as a developer annoyance solving feature. That's huge for me. So that was neat. I mean, there's tons of like laundry lists as you go through. Honestly, there's each different one was like, oh, we added this in, we added this in. There are some things, there's flags you can turn on to get C# 7 support, which is cool. And that
C# 7, what's new in 7?
Some interesting features. So one is, so that long pause was for me to reconsider how to say tuple or tuple. So I never really have heard the right answer. And so what I like to do is alternate between the two. So then I make sure I offend everybody.
But if you have a tuple that has three arguments, is that a threeple?
I don't know. These are all tough questions we'll need to answer now. So they have tuple support. They had inline function support. And then pattern matching. So, the example inside a function, we can write, you could write like a lambda expression that then had access to those, to the local variables. If you wanted to move that of that function out, if you want to refactor that function, make it a separate standalone function, now you need to pass all those locals in. And so then, that your code gets a lot more confusing. And maybe I don't want that function available for anywhere else. Maybe that function is just to make my main function a little bit smoother. So they added in this inline function support. So that's neat. Then tuples are great for just kind of this lightweight data type for passing in kind of, basically it's a lot like JSON based, like a JSON array of arrays kind of thing. So that's nice.
Let me just interrupt. Tuples, one thing that tuples do is that they simplify reference and out parameters.
Oh, yeah. So yeah. Huge point. Yeah. So that was, and then they also have added in some support there. And by added in, these were their crazy demos that they were doing on stage. And they said these, may or may not work. And we're still considering these and all that kind of stuff, those disclaimers. But so they added in ref parameters, making it a lot easier to, like, say, as you're calling in to a function that does iteration, you can have it pass you back out a reference to a specific thing in there. So if you're calling into something multiple times, you can pass in and out the reference and make it a lot more efficient and simplify the code too. And then one other thing that they showed was pattern matching. So the idea is like, say I've got a big switch case, you could do things where you could say, if the person is a teacher, so if it matches this and it has, this, then do these things. Otherwise, if it's a student with a GPA greater than this, so just adding in that kind of pattern matching thing throughout, conditionals, through case statements, really kind of, again, just simplifying the code. I've seen, developers, C# developers are kind of having mixed reaction to this. I can definitely see it simplifying my code. Some devs are saying like, wait a minute, this seems confusing, or is this really, where we want to go to. So, that's part of the process with all these things is development in the open and seeing, you can get involved as things are being built. And then you can also, have your input and say like, wait, I don't like where that's going. Do this instead. I mean, there's been a ton of that with ASP.NET as it's been developing. People saying like, wait a minute, I would prefer this. Great. Okay. Open an issue. Okay. Now we're discussing the issue. Then somebody sends in a pull request.
Well, I'm in the process of completely rewriting my C# course to be called C# 6 from scratch. And I'm hoping to have it done before they release C# 7.
So. Yeah. I don't know dates on this, but I do know that there's still things that they're kind of figuring out how they want it to work. But
the pace of change continues to be ridiculously fast.
Yeah. Just lately we had some code in here and I'm like, wait a minute, what's the syntax for an expression bodied function again? And, and then I'm still like, it took me a while to kind of deeply get link and kind of make that more, just kind of idiomatic C# for me. And the same thing with string interpolation, something I wanted in .NET and C# forever. And then we got it with C# 6, and I still find myself concatenating strings. And,
Really?
Yeah. See,
I thought link takes a while to get your brain around. But interpolation for me was like, oh, this finally works exactly the way I expect. And
I mean, it's a great feature, and it's one, like I said, I always wanted, but there's just a little bit of muscle memory of like, okay, now do this and this. And I'm like, wait a minute, snap out of it.
6 had a couple of small things, and everybody refers to them as small things. They are small things, but interpolation, the null coalescing operator, a few other things that were just really make your coding much easier.
Yeah.
But back to build. So It sounds to me like there were significant announcements and significant new technology for folks to pursue. Is all of that available now? Is all of that out?
Oh, man. I mean, it really depends on what we're talking about. So the Windows stuff, there's this anniversary update where there's a preview that I just downloaded yesterday that includes stuff like bash support. And then that's going to be like released, I believe they said this summer. Then there are a bunch of like services and bot frameworks and things like that where they have made available some in preview form. So again, it kind of depends on which specific one. The Xamarin stuff. So Xamarin was like, if you go to the Xamarin site or if you look at the blogs, like there's download things that you can start downloading and working with that, you know, today.
Yes. And they traditionally have an alpha and beta channel as well as their release channel.
Exactly. That's right. And so that's honestly like a lot of the time when we're setting up for these keynote demos, we're working with the team and they're getting us like this weird, funky installer. For the Xamarin demo, they're like, yeah, just switch to the alpha channel. They did have some little installers for the workbooks and the iOS inspector, but that I believe that's where you would get all that stuff. It's just off those alpha channels. HoloLens shipped. So that is actually something if you got $3,000 burning a hole in your pocket. The HoloLens did ship at Build. And then there's a lot of...
Now, is that targeted at developers or now at consumers?
That really is developers. And then also I would say like enterprise or, you know, like something that's worth $3,000, you know? So for instance, educational, they always show demos with that. And that's something that makes some sense. Like, you know, medical students being able to, you know, explore and move around and blow up and shrink down and stuff, you know, brains rather than, you know, poking around in a human brain. That seems worth $3,000. But then there's also things like, I've seen things with like, you know, design or, you know, building large, you know, buildings, like construction kind of jobs. That's something where having multiple people be able to collaborate, you know, meeting in the top of a skyscraper that isn't built yet, you know, and arguing about where to put the power plugs, like, that's again something that $3,000 seems pretty worthwhile. So at this, people are all kind of assuming, and I think it makes sense to see this kind of like a Tesla. Like, you know, the first Teslas cost a lot of money, and then the next ones cost less money, and the next ones cost less money, and each version kind of funds the next version a bit. So I would expect these ones, you know, these are Tesla, whatever, the original Tesla price, right? They're expensive. And then over time, I would expect as, you know, the economics of scale and electronics get cheaper and faster and better and all that stuff that, you know, I want the price to come down so I can play with one.
Absolutely. All right. Are we forgetting anything from Build?
Oh, I'm sure we are. You know, they announced IoT stuff and they announced a lot of analytics and like I said, bots and, you know, Power BI embedded. I mean, there's a huge list, but those are the things I think that I kind of know about. So that's probably a good place to stop.